Welcome to this podcast from Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. This podcast is made possible through support from the members of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club. To learn more about events or membership, visit us online at commonwealthclub.org/inforum or join us on Facebook, MySpace, and LinkedIn.
Good evening. Welcome. This is Inforum. It's a division of the Commonwealth Club by and for young people who share an interest and passion for civic issues. I'm Aaron Axelson, music director of Live 105 in San Francisco. I also run a club called Pop Scene. Been working in the music industry for a long time. Bay Area native. Tonight, as Caroline alluded to, we're going to talk about the state of underground rock, independent music, and its impact on pop culture, its impact on the music industry. And Caroline has put together a great bunch of panelists here, music experts that I have the pleasure of working with on a daily basis. So I'd like to welcome and introduce our panelists. We're going to have sort of an improvised discussion on the state of underground music, the state of independent music. And then we'll open it up to a Q&A session as well, so some questions that you guys might have for any of us. So without further ado, let's do it. Kevin Arnold right here. Kevin Arnold's the founder of the local music festival Noise Pop in its 16th year, one of the country's most reputable music festivals. Kevin Arnold is also the owner of IOTA, a global distribution company, and he's a music guru, independent Big staunch supporter of independent music, Kevin Arnold, ladies and gentlemen. Jordan Curlin, right over there. Hey, Jordan, how's it going?
Hi, Aaron.
Jordan's going to get Death Cab for Cutie to play BFD this year. Thank you very much.
only if you hit that gavel many times.
There's a gavel. Oh, this is great. And it's appropriate because I'm actually on jury duty this week, so this is fun. I've had the urge to do this all week. It's great. Yeah. Jordan, he works with Noise Pop, helps orchestrate this seminal event. Also, Jordan started Zeitgeist Management here in San Francisco. He manages a bevy of fine acts, including Death Cab for Cutie, Rogue Wave, Feist, and more. Great band called Street to Nowhere. Jordan manages them as well as all sorts of other new artists that we'll talk about. Brian Garza over there. Brian, hello. Brian is the lead singer of San Francisco band Scissors for Lefty. Perhaps you saw Scissors for Lefty this year open up BFD. That was him right there running around in his red underpants in front of 20,000 people. Scissors for Lefty, one of my favorite local bands. Yeah. Brian, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Melissa Goldstein from 7x7 Magazine. She's arts and entertainment director and a frequent writer and music reviewer for Spin.com. I call Melissa, my nickname for Melissa is Melissa Goldstein plus seven. And it's not because she works for 7x7 Magazine, but every time she wants to go to Pop Scene to see a show, she always asks for seven guests. Melissa Goldstein plus seven over there. And Michael over there, he's in a band called Rain of Frogs, correct? Michael also works for Pandora. And Michael will share his insight on being in a local artist. He's also known for 1999 projects for 52 songs. We'll talk about that. I believe that's it. Are we done? Is that it? Okay. So let's, I guess, segue into our discussion. And I guess I'll just kind of throw out a question. I'll probably start down the line here, and we'll just kind of see where this whole thing goes. Okay. So, Kevin, what's your definition of independent music?
Yeah, that's a bit of a sticky one, even for myself to talk about.
That's why I'm asking you.
I mean, I think traditionally, certainly independent music started out as being music that's not on major labels, right? That's on small record labels that are outside of what used to be five or more and is now currently four major labels. But certainly, like, over the last couple of decades, I don't even know, maybe I'd probably put it into the 80s, that those lines started to blur a lot, and people would talk about terms like indie rock or independent music. And so now I think it's a lot more about sort of just a bit of a cultural touchstone. You know, maybe it's a synonym in a way for underground. Usually it just means stuff that's a little bit outside of the mainstream. But there are people that would certainly be much stricter in their interpretation of the word and, you know, say, not listen to music on a major label or something. So
You know, I've had many heated arguments about what is independent music. Most recently with my old producer, he works at Calyx, who's kind of an indie rock elitist music snob, but I still really like the guy. We'd had a discussion about independent music, and my definition of independent music is kind of comes in two terms. I almost would say the term indie. Indie music is more of an aesthetic. I feel it's sort of synonymous or ubiquitous with a spirit, a sort of a musical, artistic, almost an avant-garde edge to it. I would classify bands like Arcade Fire or Radiohead, Death Cab for Cutie as being kind of indie artists. Now, as far as independent artists, of course, that would be sort of autonomous from a major label, artists that are on independent record labels like Barsook Records, Eeny Meeny Records, Sub Pop. So it's kind of a open, sort of a subjective term, I feel. I've had this debate many times, but my perfect example is like, okay, let's just say Arcade Fire, an indie band. What if Arcade Fire, Jordan, signed to Atlantic Records tomorrow? Would they no longer be an indie band?
Well, they'd no longer be an independent artist.
Okay.
But, I mean, I agree with your assessment, Aaron. I think it's more about an aesthetic, an approach, and sort of a spirit you take to the creative process. And, last year at Noise Pop, our closing show was with the band Cake. And, you know, Cake has sold many records over the years. And I think, you know, people were kind of confused why we would have a band like Cake, who's more well-known to be commercially successful with songs like The Distance. But people forget that, you know, Cake self-released their first record. Their second record was on an independent label. And, you know, so on technical terms, oh, yeah, they were indie rock band. They put out their own record. But, I mean, even a band like Cake, their approach is much different than things you normally hear on the radio. And I think that, you know, when Death Cab for Cutie was on a, you know, who I've managed for a number of years, they were on an independent label for the first five releases. And then they went to Atlantic Records. So that doesn't negate them being an indie rock artist. They're no longer an independent artist. But if you want to get really technical about the whole thing, almost every independent label is distributed by a company that's owned by a major label. So there isn't a whole lot of independence going on in the independent music world if you really want to get a technical. Sub Pop's actually owned 49% by Warner Music Group. So
yeah, I mean, I'd have to at least argue a little bit. Like 80% of the records put out every year are independent records that are not on the major labels. It's just that those that sell the most by a long shot are put out by major labels that are distributed to the major label systems.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I mean, I think it's important to separate indie from independent. They're definitely two different things, I guess.
Question, I guess, for Jordan, for anyone can inject into this question here, but we talk about the impact that independent underground music has had on music culture this decade. I can really attribute to one band that I feel kind of put the nail in the coffin of new metal that really made Fred Durst of Limp Bizkit like go away, thankfully. And that was really White Stripes. It was one of those first bands to really have a huge commercial impact on Sympathy for the recording label. They were on an independent label. They signed a joint deal with V2 Records. White Stripes' impact sort of set the wheel in motion. The music, you know, musical trends are very cyclical, but then with the success of the White Stripes in 2000, 2001, you see it opened the door for a bevy of other acts. How have you guys seen underground music this decade not only impact pop culture,
right,
but also the music industry? I mean, Jordan, once an episode in the OC when Death Cab for Cutie poster was up there, how did that really change the band?
Well, I mean, I think that if I could kind of rewind to the White Stripes thing, I'm only going to talk for like 15, 20 minutes and then I'll pass the mic over. I think you're right about the White Stripes. I mean, there's a period of time where the White Stripes and the Strokes and, you know, there are a couple other kind of garagey sounding or artists really started to do well. But I think what's really, if anything, sped up the proliferation of independent music, it's been the internet, you know, and that's not, I've never been a believer that, you know, the World Wide Web was going to be this great thing that was going to equalize how people heard music and found music. And if you had a guitar and you put a song up, people would hear it. That's not true. But what is true is that if you're a band, and there's positives and negatives to this, of course, too, but the reality is say 10 years ago, 1998, what was probably the biggest or most celebrated independent rock record of that year was Neutral Milk Hotel's record. That sold about 100,000 copies, and that's amazing. And that's what records at that point would sell on independent labels. The high, high end of what records would sell on independent labels. You know, fast forward, you take a band like the Arcade Fire in 2005, you know, actually same record label, but then you have websites like Pitchfork, you have blogs. You know, in 1998, you found out about new independent music that people are excited about by, you know, your weekly, all weekly magazines, college radio, and your friends, and maybe record stores. Now, a band, I mean, take Vampire Weekend, for example, for, you know, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent, but here's a band that no one knew about a year ago. They're playing in Saturday Night Live next weekend. Mm-hmm. And that all happened because they started to develop a buzz online, and then the New York Times pick up on it, et cetera, et cetera. So, and I'm so I think that where, you know, that what you also talked about, Aaron, when, you know, Death Cab for Cutie on the OC, Modest Mouse on the OC, all these indie rock bands on the OC. I mean, there was this moment where you had music supervisors starting to use independent rock, people being able to buy that music immediately by going onto iTunes or going onto Amazon. It was this great convergence. So all of a sudden, Death Cab, who before they released Transatlanticism, which is the record that came out in 2003, had sold 55,000 copies, was their highest selling record. Transatlanticism comes out. You know, people are now more accustomed to buying music online. The OC starts, you know, is a very popular show that's using predominantly independent rock because that's what the music super likes. All of a sudden, a band like Death Cab is selling four times that many records. You know, because it's people, it's access to people hearing the music and then access to people purchasing the music.
You know, it's a good point. I mean, this Vampire Weekend record sold 30,000 albums first week. It was top 20 on the Billboard charts. Yeah. Arcade Fire record did over 100,000 albums first week. Yeah. It's top 10 on the Billboard charts.
The Shins, 115,000 first week. I mean, these are numbers that, you know, bands would sell. Very few independent bands in the 90s would even reach that point. I mean, you take bands in the 90s like Sebado or Pavement. I mean, Pavement kind of broke the mold, but, you know, their big record, Cricket Rain, Cricket Raid, that was in partnership with Atlantic Records, actually. So I'll take that back. But the bands that were purely independent, Signed to Real Estate, Sebado, those were bands that sold 95, 100,000 records.
Yeah, there's definitely seems more commercial, viable success stories in today's current state of independent music. Yeah. Brian, you're lead singer of San Francisco's hottest local band, Scissors for Lefty. I know, probably off the top of my head, at least 15 major A&R executives from major record labels that have tried to court Scissors for Lefty. Always call me up, Aaron, what, tell us about Scissors for Lefty. We're looking at signing them. You know, Columbia Records is hot on your ass. What, for you guys, though, what are some of the advantages for Scissors for Lefty staying on an independent label? What are some of the advantages and the resources that you have to sort of cultivate a base and a career as being an independent artist?
Well, I kind of think of the term independent music or independent artist as more of an anthem. You know, it's this push to try to empower yourself to do as much as you can or be involved as much as you can in the production of your music and distribution and all the portions, you know, that they have to make it up with. But I really like to kind of tinker and work on the stuff myself, and I think it's really important for most emerging artists to be involved in the music themselves, the recording, the distribution, you know, so they have a good feel for where they're going and to see if they even want to pursue it. Or to see if it's representative of their personality, you know, are they, you know, is this who they want to be down the long run, or how they want to put themselves off on stage? But both you gentlemen had really good points about it's kind of an impression, you know, who is really independent, who's not. But
that was a good point, though. It's like a DIY is sort of another aesthetic that's important to what you said.
Yeah. Talk directly,
Melissa. Spin Magazine, 7x7. You get, it's kind of independent music, and the independent aesthetic has kind of been the fuel that's driven Spin and what you do personally. And tell us a little bit about the connection that you have with independent music and how you try to submerge yourself in it in a way that you're constantly remaining relevant, finding new artists from the independent music. Basically, you've made Spin and 7x7's made a you've defined a brand. You guys made a brand from supporting the scene. How? Tell us a little bit about your take on the state of independent music?
Well, I think in terms of finding music, it's like it's there's not necessarily, you know, a roadmap for finding something. It seems really a lot of chance, actually, I think. I mean, you're certainly talking to publicists a lot, and there are people that you trust. And, you know, when it comes to publicists also, when you're talking to someone at a major label or an independent label, I was talking to someone about this the other day, there's definitely something to be said for labels that put out fewer releases. You tend to sort of trust those more. So I think in the music industry, there's like a big conversation about major labels and are they, you know, going to just all die out in the next, you know, couple years, and all of these small labels like, you know, Saddle Creek and Sub Pop and I'm trying to think of what other ones, Merge, Matador. They're the ones that are doing well because they are a little bit more selective with their bands, and it seems like they make deals with them where it is more of an independent flavor. So maybe you trust that taste more than, you know, the albums that are coming from the bigger labels. So that's part of it. When I think, when I'm talking to publicists, I definitely look at where the music's coming from. But the other part of it is certainly just online. I mean, I'm definitely on all of those blogs all the time. I mean, I'm looking at spin.com, but I'm looking at Stereo Gum and Pitchfork and, you know, anything that's out there. And then it's just people that you trust to turn you on to a band. I mean, that's like probably most of my favorite bands have come that way. I'd love to take credit for all of them. But I think really talking to people and going to shows, I think that's where I end up finding out about other bands, just talking to people at shows. So I don't know. I mean, the more information that's out there, sometimes it can be harder to find something good because it is so easy and there is no barrier to entry for anyone can just, you know, have a band online. In some ways, I think that can make it more difficult to find something, but in other ways, it will find you in a way. Like, you know, the bands that are able to rise to the top without signing and do get some sort of groundswell on blogs, you're going to find out about them. So I don't know. Does that answer your question?
My question was so vague anyways. Yeah, sure. But independent music is still in its du jour. It's still in, it's very, it's a chic, it's a very attractive, like we talked about, there's a lot of major, you know, TV shows that use independent music in their, you know, adverts and using them in movie soundtracks and whatnot. You guys putting Vampire Weekend on the cover, this issue of Spin Magazine, over, let's say, the new Godsmack record. So, I mean, it's right. Still, you know what I'm talking about? Like,
yeah,
the state
yeah.
of independent, it's still, there is, within the community of tastemakers and hipsters and within that, there is something about it right now that it's still, it's infiltrated mainstream culture.
Yeah. Well, Vampire Weekend is kind of, yeah, it's kind of amazing. I feel like all of media sort of like lined up for them. And I think part of that, I mean, certainly I think it's a trend in music right now, that whole Afro pop influence. I feel like they kind of seized on that. And that sort of prep chic, I mean, they look the part and they sound the part, and they're sort of, they've got this Paul Simon sort of angle happening. And I feel like, you know, bands that get a lot of success and get really trendy a lot of times will be referencing someone. You know, for a while it was like everyone was referencing David Byrne, and
right.
I'm not saying that it's going to be, you know, a bunch of Paul Simon bands, but Vampire Weekend, I mean, I just think that they're different enough that they obviously made an impact in the media. But also they're drawing on something that's really easy to listen to, that's kind of striking a chord all over the place. I don't know.
You know what's coming, it's going to be hot in 2008, is Billy Joel. Just listen to the new Spoon record, and it's like, it's so Billy Joel. So I get phone calls when we play Spoon on Live 105, and from my upper demographic going, is this a lost Billy Joel selection? Is this from some lost sessions? Michael, I have a question for you. We're talking about the pros and cons of blogs and how it's a obviously a valuable resource to help expedite a band getting out there, getting the word out, helping cultivate a community. Do you see anything detrimental to, let's say, a band getting too much hype too early on in their career?
Definitely. You know, I think, I don't know what your experience is like, but if you put something out now, you have your first review, you know, the minute somebody opens the package of your record. So I think that there's a loss of credibility. I think there's just so much noise about music right now, and there's kind of this frenzy for people to be, you know, scooping blogs to scoop the next blog, and I think that it kind of has a detrimental effect maybe on the criticism of the music, and maybe and just in general, if you're reading a blog, even a good blog that says there are 250 best new bands in 1 year, I think you have to sort of in the back of your mind be kind of like, you know, what do you mean? I mean, shouldn't it be that much better than the other bands in order to really get that kind of, you know, that kind of critical reaction? And I also think just when people have to hurry to blog, they don't have the time to absorb music properly. And you know, I think it's a great time for artists. It's a great time for music, and it's a great time for criticism. But it's just it's like buried in just so much noise. I mean, you know, when you go out and look for music, or when you put a record out, you just never know what you're going to get out there. So I think the blog thing, like anything else, is sort of, you know, a blessing and a curse. I mean, I wouldn't trade it. I think it's much better than having just a few kind of locked up, very expensive outlets for publicity. But I don't know. I mean, I wonder if anyone here has, you know...
Well, that type of bandwagon criticism will sort of, like, cancel itself out after a while. Like, if it's just about rah-rahing everything that's, like, the hottest new thing, then you sort of lose credibility right away.
Totally.
I still think, like, trusted sources for finding something new, you know, it's just like a, you know, it's blogs are in a very large way like a label is now. It's like you can go and ideally you can trust it. Most of the stuff that this guy writes about or actually endorses fits my profile enough that I'm going to trust that guy, just like you trust a record off of Merge or Sub Pop or Matador.
No one or you.
And that's a good part about it. You can have a real filter out there.
Yeah, I mean, they're saying as the music industry continues to evolve, and obviously the digital revolution, has had a huge impact on the state of the music industry. But you look at sort of social networking sites really as the new vehicle to promote music, it's also going to be kind of a new platform for the new record label. You got MySpace Records that are starting to put out records. Mm-hmm. You have the iMeme social networking service. It's getting, you know, they signed a deal with all the record companies. Mm-hmm. They signed a deal with Snowcap. They're going to start selling music directly through iMeme. You got... Who's that guy, Perez Hilton? I'm acting like I don't know who he is. I read his blog every day. He signed a deal today with Warner Brothers. He now has a record. He has a record label now through Warner Brothers. So you're seeing this happen. But Jordan, my question really, though, for you guys is I feel people are putting a little bit too much of their eggs in one basket here. Yes, the digital revolution is massively successful, but not at the point where it can be in lieu of traditional marketing. Traditional avenues of helping break artists. You can't just, I have 10,000 hits on my MySpace page. We made it big. Yep. Go to Amoeba Records. Look in their 25-cent budget bin. There's maybe 10,000 CDs you can buy for a quarter. If you give each one of those a blog, you give each one of those bands a MySpace page, does that automatically mean they broke?
Well, no, I mean, I think that, I mean, it goes back to, you know, I think that There is. First, I want to comment on kind of the overhypeness of blogs, or when a band gets that hype too early. And I talked before, probably for a little bit too long, about access, that artists now have that weren't available 10 years ago. But I think, you know, the flip side of that is you're getting a lot of bands who are getting a lot of attention, or maybe not a lot of bands. You're getting a few bands who are getting a lot of attention too early, who aren't able to really deliver when they come through town. You know, a band like Clap Your Hands and Say Yeah, who were kind of a lightning the bottle situation a few years ago, the band, you know, their popularity grew very quickly because of the internet, and they started playing rooms that were way too big, and it was not a good experience for audience members, and I think it really hurt them. You know, I think that, you know, and that can be a negative effect of it. But Aaron, I mean, I totally agree with you. It's not just because you have, just because, I mean, the reality is this. Artists have more power than they've ever had because they have the ability to communicate with their fans on a mass level. Through websites, through MySpace, through Facebook, through whatever it is. But that doesn't mean, you know, just because you put something up doesn't mean people are going to come to it. It still is about it being a great song or a great sound or a great vibe, and then it's still about all those magical things that line up that oftentimes you just can't even quantify. Why is it Vampire Weekend and it's not, you know, and it's not
tapes and tapes.
Yeah, I mean, it's not another band who, yeah, it's just there's certain things, the inexplicable quality that you know, it happens. And, you know, it's certainly, you know, I can't say why, you know, Death Cab is the band that 2003, you know, got all that attention and now sells a million records, when it could have been four or five or six other bands at that point. You know, it just, there was something there that happened and it clicked on a level you can't really explain. Well, I mean, or aside from managerial genius, I mean, that's really the only quantifiable thing. But I mean, you know, aside from that,
Just because it's good. I mean, you can find fans if you're good more quickly than ever and rise in popularity. But the thing is, if you don't have staying power or your talent is a fluke or limited, you fall just as quickly too,
well,
right?
I have a question for you,
Mr. Arnold, if I may be so bold.
Yeah, sure.
Yes. Aaron, can you hit the
Just be fast about it?
Yeah. But, okay, so with IOTA, how many labels do you distribute currently?
Like several thousand, close to 5,000 maybe.
Good question.
Let's say you distribute 5,000 labels. How many of those labels comprise the top 5% of your labels? What'd you say?
Probably close to about 200 that comprise the top 5%. And then there's about another 600 or so that would be like the top 20%.
Okay.
So there's absolutely a curve. Yeah, there's a curve just like there is in, you know, it's like we are part of the long tail or perhaps the middle segment of that tail, but certainly within our ecosystem, there's a similar curve.
I thought the long tail is dead. Didn't Chris Anderson?
I think it's a mistake, though.
I'm sorry.
I think it's a mistake to completely correlate sales with quality just because of all the complexities of putting stuff out and the cumulative advantage of putting something out on a known label or touring with the right bands. I think largely stuff that sells a lot or is popular, it always has something good. At least it has some usefulness for people, whether it's entertainment or it's art or some hybrid of the two or whatever. And at the very highest level, they merge, and you know the greatest entertainment becomes art, and I suppose vice versa.
Creed, for example.
Take Creed, please.
Well, I like what you're touching on about entertainers or entertainment. I mean, if you're going to go to the work of actually recording and documenting your music, you're no longer just a musician. You're willfully putting yourself into the shoes of being an entertainer because you're going to, you know, you intend to show this to other people and present it, and you have to kind of accept the responsibilities of what that entails. And if you're a good entertainer, you know, and that's one of the problems I've seen with a lot of bands. And we've done a lot of touring over the past 2 years, maybe 250 shows, and that's a lot of good music, but it didn't necessarily always cut the mustard. It was more, were they personable? Could they reach out to the audience, and do they have some kind of, you know, common thread or maybe some, you know, some modest manners, or, you know, like at least interacting more than just having just a representation of the CD. And so that's just something you have to keep in mind, I think, is that strong entertainers do rise to the top sometimes, and people can't understand it because their music might really not seem to really match, but they just are personalities that people like to identify with, you know, and sometimes people might want to have more of a personality to identify with more than, you know, and then hope that more good music comes, you know, than sometimes just specifically quote-unquote good music. Because I mean, most everyday folks, it's easy to get into them. You know, if you work at college radio or, you know, any radio station, or you're really heavily involved with a lot of blogging, you're around a lot of movers and shakers. But most folks, you know, like my aunts and uncles, they're like, what is this indie music thing? I try to tell people what you are, And it's hilarious because they think it has something to do with racing, you know, or race cars. And you know, I go, it moves fast, it moves real fast, you know, and like, but I think most folks, they just, you know, they like to find some personalities they identify with, and they, and, you know, there's enough momentum behind them, and hopefully they have done their share of playing shows and kind of then having a lot of pitfalls and a lot of, you know, odd moments that they have now this package, this product that's a little more lasting.
I feel like, to Brian's point, just even talking about the idea of success, like, so much now it seems like there's always this conversation about selling records and are people buying music and the whole thing, and it's just completely upped the need for a band to be a live band, I think. Like, you know, festivals, there's more festivals than ever, and they're starting all the time, and I feel like the success of a band is completely contingent on their ability to deliver live. You know, you can have all that buzz, and like you said, with Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah, I mean, it's like, you can have all that buzz, and you can have a great record, but, like, I think the ones that will end up surviving and the ones that sort of capture, you know, that attention, which... You know, when we were talking about Vampire Weekend, so far they have been able to deliver live, and I think that's an important point.
Hey, Jordan, what percentage would you say of an artist's revenue from all the various, from publishing, from album sales, from downloads, what would you say at this point the percentage of revenue that's generated from touring?
I mean, touring's always been one of the, you know, the primary sources of income. I mean, it really depends on the band. I mean, some bands can sell lots and lots of records and not, you know, and not sell a lot of tickets. But if you're a touring artist, it's going to be your touring and merchandise and publishing is where you're going to make your money. I mean,
it's a big difference between Widespread Panic and like Lupe Fiasco.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing is that you think of. I mean, I remember, you know, Take a Band. I remember a couple summers ago, you know, where we had, you know, Death Cab for Cutie played two nights at the Greek and sold about 17,000 tickets. And then Train came about a month later, and, you know, Train has sold millions and millions of records and sold about 3,000 tickets at the same venue. You know, it's just certain bands, it's different, you know, it's just different approach. I mean, I think a lot of the bands that we're talking about, a lot of the styles we're talking about, these are bands that really kind of are touring artists, and they are bands that this is how they their primary way that they make money. They go out, they release a record, and this is how they're going to spread their music, first
and
foremost.
I think Train needs to find a new manager. Jordan, are you available?
Yes.
You know, the interesting thing, though, I think, is that, you know, it is true that right now the same rules apply from before all the technology was, all, you know, this, but from 15 years ago that will apply in 250 years if there's anybody around making music. Mm-hmm. It's still a person or a group of people making something that's compelling and has value for somebody who's listening, and either making a record that's a document that's, you know, compelling enough, or having a live show, or hopefully both. They're different, you know, those are different skills as well, and different things work in those contexts. But the thing that interested me when I read the blurb about this was that you know, historians sometime in the future who look back at this time are going to find this incredible, incredible explosion of recordings. I feel kind of bad for them because the fact is it's so easy to record now that literally everybody in here could go home and record something. And when you manufacture it or spit it out of your computer... on a certain level, it's indistinguishable from anything else. And so there's this explosion of amateurism, which then blends into independent music or unsigned music, blends into independent music, and then blends into indie music, which is, I think, what we've been talking mostly about are the bands that people know and who are a part of a more organized, kind of structured environment where, you know, they're registering nationally or regionally through their labels or through whatever their scenes are. But if you're a historian in 300 years and you're not, you know, yes, you'll know about Death Cab for Cutie and you'll know about Train, but when you look at what's happening here and what independent music is, it's like if every folk musician in history could have made their own record. And I think it's just really interesting. I actually end up hearing a lot of this music, and the truth is a lot of it is just not, it's just not good. It's not good at all.
But it's still,
God concur. Bless them, you know, but it's just, there's concur. So much recorded music now.
The accessibility but can you of recording.
That, you could say that about almost any medium at this point, though.
Yeah,
any
that's true,
medium,
too.
Whether it's film or, taking blogs, for example.
But ultimately, I mean, you wouldn't say that's a bad thing for the artist, would you, right?
I think there's a beautiful...
It
could be a bad thing for the listener, however.
Well, that's the listener's problem, right? Like, I mean, you've got to get through, you know, you've got to find the fans, right? That's easier than ever, too. So it's easier to record. Everything's been democratized. Technology's super cheap. You can make music cheaply. You can get it in front of people cheaply. If it sticks, it'll stick. Like, there's no obligation for somebody to listen twice.
I think there's a neat caveat, though, is, you know, sure, there's a lot of paint at Home Depot, but how many people necessarily want to go out and paint every day? It takes some time and energy to put songs together, you know, and to make them. So, yeah, it is easier. It is quite easy to capture an idea if you got one, if you have a good one.
You know
But I don't think that people are just, you know, all over the place. I mean, I think it's great that they have the opportunity to tinker at home.
I'm not making music.
I personally love it. I like recording at home, and I like how easy it is to some degree, because you don't have the pressure of someone else's interpretation of what you should sound like, or you can't weird out properly, you know, because you have, you know, the bright lights, and it's, you have to take the good with the bad, I think. And
it's just that it's less expensive to create it, and it costs nothing to get it out there. I think it's the main thing, which is why I'm going to start my crunk band pretty soon.
No, I challenge you to, though. To write a good song is not easy. You know, and if you did it as an easy means, you know, that I think that was good that it was that accessible to do it. Because it's, I think people kind of, you know, they belittle the idea that anyone can go now write a song, and they're not. You know, I tried to get, you know, friends of mine to cut ideas. I say, this is all you have to do, turn it on, this is the track, and blah, blah, blah. And they don't put the time into it, because there's a certain personalities that like to pursue that, you know, and there's other people who, you know, probably were really good at it, but they just are too preoccupied with other things in life, you know, that they don't get around to it. So it's still certain personalities, you know, that I think are pursuing it like they always.
But I mean, I'd say if it's like, I don't know if it's summation time yet, but certainly like between the ease of recording and the ease of reaching fans and actually being able to tour, sell money on the back, or sell music on the, you know, sell recorded music on the backs of that, it's I think it'd be hard to argue that it's not better than it ever has been.
Oh, the
for
barrier
an independent
entry is
artist
low.
And like independent market share absolutely. Is growing. It's like from 15 or 20% to close to 30 now, and whether or not those labels happen to be distributed to a major, as they often are in the US for the top labels, it's not that way in the rest of the world. And
I just, you know, like looking on MySpace when you see total views and then total listens. And you like to make sure that ratio of the listens is greater than the views, because that means someone might have been more compelled to listen a couple times rather than 300,000 views and 28 listens. You're like, man, this sure didn't go very far. You know, and then you
we have
what up to.
Was it 8 minutes before the exciting Q&A session begins. One thing I wanted to elaborate really quickly, too, is we talked about the evolution of the music industry in this decade and the state of independent music and how it's benefited. And Michael, you brought this up as well, but I feel there's still a component that's always going to exist in the music industry, and that's what I call filters. You're still going to need tradesmen. They're people that are good at their craft to find the best music to write about, to find the best bands to manage, to find the best bands to book for festivals. They're still going to, even though there's this DIY and there's this putting the power of information into the power of the average consumer, for the most part, what I've learned from my research and my extensive focus groups is that too much information is a bad thing. Too much information can be a crippling component for the mainstream audience. So, you know, I get 500 CDs a week. Do you think all my listeners want to hear all 500 CDs just because they can? Just because there's a MySpace page or a blog talking about them? They still have certain brand expectations where they want someone to filter through 500 bands and find the top 10 bands they want. That's the biggest misconception I feel about the blog generation, is it automatically makes everybody into a music connoisseur. For the most part, people, music doesn't impact them the way it does everyone in this room. For the most part, they're content with hearing the Red Hot Chili Peppers, sorry to say. So there's, you know, obviously there's more outlets and there's more avenues now.
Would arguably Red Hot Chili Peppers, I mean, they were an independent band in the 1980s. Okay, and we won't go. But
see Aaron, what I'm saying, though.
But I think, I mean, I totally agree with your point. I think that the level of kind of fandom is going to dictate that. I mean, certain people are going to look for maybe just one filter, and that's Live 105 or that's K-Fog or that's Alice, and that's where they get their music. Another person, it might be they listen to the radio and they watch MTV, and another person might be listen to the radio, watch MTV, and read Spin, and going from there and kind of their different sources. But I think, you know, what blogs have really done is, you know, you... And still, you find someone whose opinion you trust. It's just like finding a magazine. It's like a zine.
Or like a good cook at a restaurant. You go there because, you know, you could cook your food at your house if you want, but there's a certain restaurant you want because you know that cook's going to serve something up.
Yeah, it's like knowing that Music for Robots is going to post songs that I'm probably, you know, more often than not going to like. It's like going to a good boutique record store. You know, I mean, that's what it is, and it's just that different...
We're getting ready to jump into the Q&A section.
I hate that fallacy about that. Yeah. I totally agree that... And it's like DJs. I mean, I work for an automated radio service, or it's not automated exactly, but the playlists are made by an algorithm. And, you know, all things being equal, many, many times I'd rather listen to Kalex than hear, you know, somebody really play a specifically chosen... set of songs that have, I think that, you know, human beings are the ultimate technology. It's not, you know, so in terms of like the credibility of blogs and that boutique record store, in fact, I mean, the best music is often that I think the best music that's available now is often available through mail order places online and with the most interesting catalogs and the most dedicated people. And, I think that's good. I hope it stays like that.
Yeah, I mean, you could even look at Live 105 as kind of a microcosm of filtering here, and it's like you have Live 105, the general playlist, and then you have, you know, Soundcheck, which is for people who are more interested in digging a little bit deeper.
One of the things I've learned in programming a major market commercial radio station for so many years is, again, understanding people's expectations, understanding their limitations. Sometimes I feel... introducing new music to the masses is sort of analogous with having a four-year-old eat broccoli, okay? They don't like it. It's a threatening element. Yeah. But to get the four-year-old to eat that delicious piece of broccoli, you got to, you know, sandwich it with two pieces of cheese. Oh, they love it. Same thing with introducing. When I'm going to introduce Arcade Fire to 500,000 people here in the Bay Area, I'm going to have two pieces of cheese around that Arcade Fire record, and that's Smashing Pumpkins and Nirvana. There's a process to introduce music to the masses. And you know, for example, take my club, Pop Scene, which is full of, you know, 400 or 500 hipster cool kids every week. If I was DJing at peak time and I played nothing but 2 hours of unfamiliar, brand new music that I narcissistically loved and want everyone to hear, no one would dance. So there's still a process that goes into it. There's a methodology of introducing music to the, and same thing with noise pop. You know, you guys are gonna use your instinct and your gut to book the best bands that are gonna define your brand. You're not just gonna have 500 bands, or you're just going to read all the hottest blog. You know, there's a process that goes into it.
But do you think your job, I'm interested though, is your job easier, meaning is knowing what to stick in the middle of that sandwich? Has that changed at all from like 5 or 10 years ago when there were no blogs?
That and
there
was is
like
a great no question. And we'll end it with this and we'll do the Q&A session. But yes, the great thing about the world of the blog and the current state of the music industry is that it's the playing field has been leveled. Back in the 90s when I started as music director, my primary job was dealing with the record companies. I was dealing with, you know, Warner Brothers and Geffen Records and Epic and Columbia. And it was this big major label monolithic kind of whole process where that kind of the little guy or these small independent artists really didn't have a voice. And in this day and age, my relationship with Sub Pop or Matador or Merge or Eeny Meeny Records or, you know, Sub whatever label is pretty much on the same playing field now as a major label. My relationships with the independent artists. And now because of I can use these resources to follow what's going on and the hottest blog bands or the bands that are selling or getting college radio airplay or whatnot, I can use that, you know, as well as my Soundcheck show to sort of experiment and try to find the best acts. If there might be 50 great worthy independent artists, my job is to find the best 7 or 8 of those. To take to the masses.
So you can like subvert the majors essentially in the same way that sort of a blog might be subverting the sort of mainstream press.
Yeah.
And like the great thing is it's all about, you know, power being taken away from the very tight control of mainstream media and owners. So whether it's the majors trying to promote to you or, you know, commercial radio versus, you know, college radio or whatever it is, all that stuff is definitely more leveled, which is a great thing.
Yeah, it is a great thing. And I feel with the state of independent music, it has time, again, to organically develop. It has time to, you know, to find a passionate fan base. The problem with the 90s, the music industry in the late 90s, was you get a band that would get signed to a $1 million deal because maybe K-Rock spun it two times. And next thing you know, we're surrounded in a world of bands like Lit. You know, it was like a bunch of disposable rock bands. And that's what I think the state of music right now is incredible compared to what it was in the late 90s with a lot of these bands that, again, have more of a voice. They have a larger vehicle to take their music to the masses. And I think it's a positive thing. All right, Caroline, it's time to go to questions now. Q&A session. Does anybody have any questions? And should they jump over there on the mic? If you could state your name and what city you're from.
I've got a question about the release model of Radiohead's latest record, In Rainbows. Because they released it for free. I think it was free for a month or so. Maybe it still is. I don't know. And they built a lot of buzz that way. I mean, it's Radiohead, so they probably would have had a lot of buzz anyways. And then it went to record stores. I think it sold 100,000 copies its first week, even though it had been free for so long. How did that work? And is that sort of distribution model something that a smaller band could use to some extent? Like, could Scissors for Lefty put their next record out for free for a while? Do you think people would pay attention to that and then go buy the record, even if they could have gotten it for free for download?
I'll feel that. I think that the way that, for people who aren't familiar, what happened is Radiohead decided they were going to offer their record on their website for a pay-what-you-want model. So you could take it for free. All you had to do is register, you know, to get your information, or you could pay $20. It was, in my opinion, a very smart marketing tool. And, I mean, that's what it really was. You know, they ended up, it was a lower...
For Radiohead.
It was a lower...
It created so much frenzy just on the process.
Right, but it was a lower... It was not as... it was a lower bit rate. You know, it was lower sound quality than what they released 2 months later in stores. You know, of course, in the music business, people knew that record was coming out in January, just a couple months later, but to the consumer had no idea. So people maybe paid for the record twice, whatever it is. It was really a marketing approach. And I think, but to answer your question in terms of, I think for certain artists, yeah, you could sell direct. Some artists are doing it direct to consumer. It could be subscription model. I mean, one of my clients, Bob Mould, was in the band Husker Du and Sugar, and he just released a new record. And, you know, Bob's talked about just, you know, rather than putting records out, just subscription model every month or every year. Someone pays a fee and he'll put X amount of songs up on his site and, you know, that type of thing. I think it just depends on the artist. I think the new band thing, it goes into what we've been saying, which is just because you're creating something doesn't mean people are going to want to listen. The demand has to be there.
Brian, would you do it?
Well, we kind of have been. Thanks for that to some degree. I mean, for a band of our size, we're just enthusiastic that there are people that want to hear it. You know, so when we first started, I mean, I would just burn a different CD every show because I made them myself. You know, we'd just say, hey, here's this week's CD. You know, it's a little different than last week's. I remixed it and fixed that one little crackle. And but over time, I mean, you do have a responsibility to find some way to, you know, to support the idea, you know, because it's, you know, you graduate college, mm-hmm. you have a credit card that lasts about this far, you know, and you can put a lot of that on there. But at some point you say, I would love to make these shows happen, but you got to find a way to at least pay to get there, you know, and it's, you know, I don't think bands ask that much. It's like, it is interesting when someone says, I'd like to charge $1 for a song, and it's absurd. Like, well, I spend about, you know, maybe anywhere between 2-3 days to a week or two on this. Would you like to buy it for 99 cents? And it's, you know, oh, it's highway robbery, you know, especially when people bought tapes for 10 bucks in the 80s. Time value of money, $10 today, you know, should be like, what? I mean, I don't think they should cost more than $11.
I mean, I think the general consensus in the industry is that certainly it's a Radiohead thing, not like a new right. model thing.
It's a great experiment. I'm really glad they did it because I know a lot of other folks have been doing it.
Well, Trent Reznor did it with Saul Williams, right? So he put out the Saul Williams record where you could pay $0 or $5.
It's a big investment just to make your own CDs.
Sold 27,000 records.
Right.
It just wasn't. And think about it, too. Radiohead, too, I mean, obviously they're a large enough band where it would work for them. I don't think it would be applicable for every
What they
artist.
Did is they monetized their leak. Like, back to what we were talking about the blogs before. Like, people, you don't have control over when the press gets your music anymore. So you send it to any press and it's immediately available online through any peer-to-peer network. So all they did is said, we aren't going to send it to anybody. We're just going to put it up ourselves right away. And they made a ton of money off of it, more than they would have made you know, through their record sales. So.
Yeah, and then they go do a big record deal. They get an advance that way, and then they go on tour.
Good. Let's get to another question. Yeah. Hi.
Hi, my name's Ashley. I'm from Oakland. I grew up mostly on the East Coast, and moving out to California, I found a huge difference between what was being played out there versus what was being played out here. And I kind of feel like the indie scene is definitely blowing up huge out here, but the radio stations kind of on the East Coast don't really see as much, and I was kind of wondering about your opinion on that.
Well, the crazy thing is right now, the state of commercial alternative radio is kind of in a state of flux. There's a lot of radio stations not on the East Coast that don't exist anymore. We used to have a seminal station, WHFS in Washington, that's not around anymore. 99X in Atlanta, big market on the East Coast, not around anymore. So from a business model, I know a lot of big, giant corporations, Clear Channel or CBS Broadcasting, have sort of jettisoned this niche alternative format for other more commercially viable format. So I think from a commercial radio standpoint on the East Coast, it's affected the scene, the music scene out there, because there isn't that those big local outlets. It's most of the flourishing alternative radio stations exist on the West Coast. And you think about, okay, what about satellite radio? Satellite radio is the answer. You know, satellite radio combined with XM and Sirius has maybe 15 million total subscribers. That's like Los Angeles and the Bay Area combined, and that's on a national, on a global scale. So satellite radio hasn't made that impact yet, but hopefully with some of the things we talked about with blogs and internet radio stations and whatnot, those can become new viable outlets to promote music. But you look at the West Coast and its correlation with K-Rock 91X in San Diego, KNRK in Portland, The End in Seattle. Jordan, you see that when we're playing a record, look at the album sales. Like Vampire Weekend debuted at number 2 in San Francisco.
Yeah, I mean, I think the West Coast has some more adventurous modern rock stations, but also then you look at the Bay Area specifically, and the reason why Noise Pop's been able to survive, for as you know, as long as we have and been able to operate, is because of the great college radio stations in the market too: KUSF, CalX, KZSU, KFJC, things of that nature. I mean, but yeah, there's definitely a much different approach to radio on a commercial and a college level on the West Coast versus the East Coast.
You'd think there'd be more, but there's a lot more basements on the East Coast usually for bands to practice in, which is very difficult for bands to practice, at least in this city, because you have a neighbor above and left below you. But
I always thought there was more.
It's easier to tour here though than it is the East Coast. Parking's easier sometimes. There's not tolls on the freeway as much. The weather's less extreme. I mean, that's a big
that the East Coast cities are so much closer. Yeah.
That's true.
Major cities are closer.
You don't have to drive all night every year.
Philadelphia never really works out, though, for most up-and-coming bands.
Yeah. there's also a bit of a paradox. You think about the burgeoning New York scene. You know, there's two alternative rock radio stations in New York, but bands like Vampire Weekend and Interpol and MGMT are breaking out of the West Coast because of the radio stations that, again, Jordan alluded to, are a little more adventurous, a little more audacious with their programming. I think it's a combination, and there's a lot of different elements that go into it. Another question over there.
Good evening. My name is Billy. I missed the beginning, so forgive me if you already went over this. But what's your definition of success? If you appeal to the masses, does that automatically ruin your street cred or whatever? I mean, are there any big, huge bands out there that aren't cheese, as you guys put it earlier?
That's a good question.
Sure.
Well, I mean, I think we talked about them and. George, like certainly the bands you work with, Death Cab and Feist, both of them super successful bands that I would think all of us would agree like have maintained some degree of credibility. Same with White Stripes.
Yeah, but you know I'm a gifted individual.
I wasn't really talking about you.
When I do play the band Anti Flag, who had a long career as a punk rock band on Fat Records, local label. They signed to RCA Records, and I can't tell you how many times when I play Anti Flag that I get complaints from the hardcore. I mean, it's a small percentage of people, but. Oh man, this band sold out. They're on that mentality though. Doesn't it seem a bit archaic?
It's not as much just because. I mean, and I think part of it is because the dissemination of information and music has gotten so much easier. I think at a point, there's that thing where you want to go to a show,
And you want this ownership, or you want to feel special, and it's smaller and it's special because you're one of the few people who knows it. And then when people start showing up that maybe, you know, it's a real community aspect. And then when it gets bigger, maybe there's people who show up that you wouldn't want to have a beer with or a cup of coffee with, and it starts to lose a little bit of the special nature. And I think that, you know, but there are plenty of bands out there who I think have reached differing levels of success, and their music hasn't really changed. I mean, I think in a band like the Red Hot Chili Peppers are an easy target because, yeah, they've totally changed. Every record is completely formulaic. You know, it's like anything they've released since the early 90s, you could pretty much interchange with, you know, the last five records. You could put one on and it doesn't really matter what it is. But there's still a lot of bands. I mean, I think Green Day is a band that, you know, obviously on Lookout Records, punk rock band. And I think they're as credible and vital as they were when they were putting records out back then. You know,
yeah, I don't
even
think
though they were
really
the big, one of the biggest rock bands in the world, right?
Follow the labels as much as they used to. I remember working on record stores. I worked at Maud Lang Records for six years in Berkeley. And, you know, some, you know, indie rock snobs would come in and not buy a record because, oh, they're now on Atlantic Records, not Barsook. I'm not buying this record. I don't know if I feel that as much anymore. Melissa, in your experience working at 7x7 and Spin, is there a specific incident or a specific example of an artist that you feel you guys have supported to a point where there might be a backlash because of its commercial? Oh, they're on the cover of Spin now. I'm not going to buy the new Vampire Weekend record.
Well, I don't know. I've been wondering about, you know, I feel like you bring up Feist, for example, and I don't think that I've come into contact with a lot of people that have had a problem with an artist who's been on an iPod commercial or anything with Apple, really. Like, I feel like there used to be, or like on, you know, the OC or Gossip Girl or whatever, like those soundtracks. I feel like, I guess like in indie rock especially, it's become a bit more acceptable. I don't know if that's just my opinion.
No, I agree.
But
kind of desensitized.
I mean, it was sort of like, yeah, it was sort of like all of a sudden it was kind of okay to, you know, market your music a little bit.
It's almost like, yeah.
How about Flaming Lips? How about Flaming Lips with Zune?
Yeah.
Because that's one of those weird ones where I'm a big fan, and also I saw that, I was like, ugh.
I really feel that.
Yeah, I mean, everyone does it.
The Flaming Lips would sell anything. I mean, the Flaming Lips has always been very, very open.
It depends, like, you know, you hear of Montreal's song on the, what is it? Outback Steakhouse.
That was the one that might have crossed the line. I mean, that's the only one that you hear about that maybe crossed the line.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
But the Shins were on a McDonald's commercial.
Yeah, I don't feel like there's like a huge backlash. I mean, I guess it depends on what.
I feel the backlash really generates now from jealous musicians. It's really a small percentage of people on Craigslist. Uh-huh. Oh, my band's not at this level, so I'm going to bitch about it. I really feel a lot of it stems
to
that.
Yeah, and it could be the genre of music,
it's a vocal minority.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My opinion.
Billy,
I definitely think it's the genre of music. I mean, hip hop music, a lot of hip hop bands are avowedly commercial, and it's not, you know, it's acceptable, and in fact it's a, you know, point of pride of how many records somebody sells or how much money, you know, a hip hop artist might, certain genres of hip hop. And indie rock is just, you know, has a kind of culture of, you know, using the term kind of gently of pure, it wants to be more pure because it's coming out of a punk rock ethic. You know, there's a sense of like music for music's sake and music for culture's sake. And you know, there's something wholesome about bands making a living. We want good bands to make more records. But there's also, you know, on a deep level, it takes a more sophisticated listener to be able to say, well, you know, I used to just have this song to myself, and now I have to share it with the Outback Steakhouse. And, you know, there is something that's kind of a... There's something with indie rock and with punk, stuff that came from punk rock, which was so, you know, so much about community that is just, I think, always going to be uncomfortable with, you know, big commercial visibility. But then there's whole other worlds of music where that's not the case at all.
Yeah, that's a good point. I don't think you're going to hear a Fugazi song in a Sizzler commercial anytime soon. I want to be
in the room with Ian when that happens, for sure.
To some degree, though, it's become more acceptable.
Well, did the band define the ideals, or did the fans do it for them? It's sort of a different
thing. But Fugazi couldn't survive anymore. I mean, the thing is about Fugazi's model wouldn't work anymore.
That's a good point.
You know, because of how everything's changed. The $6 a show, $9.99 CD, that just wouldn't happen. Yeah. You know, they wouldn't.
I believe we have time for one more question. One more question. Let's do it. Hey there.
My name's Greg Gordon. I'm the director of a music production school here in San Francisco called Paramind. And we get a ton of students coming in who are super psyched about all the new technology, realize actually the depth and complexity of all this new technology, and want to produce high-quality music. You know, high sample rates, 192, all this great stuff that's out there. Yet we're saddled by MP3s and the low quality of the majority of music that's being distributed online. So my question to you is, do you see in our near future, I know that the CD sales have been declining pretty dramatically, but they still account for the majority of music sales out there. Yeah. At this stage of the game, you know, I know that major labels have now released DRM-free music via Amazon, and they're flooding the marketplace with DRM-free music, and they're pushing the ante up from what iTunes has been, you know, the standard level of distribution quality that iTunes has been putting out there. Do you see quality becoming a greater issue in the distributed music, how it's being sold, and do you see an ultimate demise of the CD, or is the CD going to live on forever?
That's a great question. I just know from the amount of music that I get submitted to at the radio station from so many bands that put together something really quickly, sort of, you know, alleviating that process that goes into really producing a solid record, I'd say there's a good, you know, 30 or 40% of stuff that's just not playable. There's a lot of records that I just can't play, that the sound quality is so poor, the MP3 quality is so poor, it's not ready for, you know, commercial radio airplay. Someone want to chime in on Brian?
Well, it's funny though, a lot of the greats, you know, their best music usually is sometimes the lowest quality mixes or the you know, they're pushed and rushed, you know, compared to some of the stuff they make later in their career that's the highest fidelity. It just doesn't have that magic sometimes. And so it's, I think you have to kind of take the good with the bad. You're going to have low quality recordings that appeal to people because they're not listening in high quality environments. You know, they might be, you know, there's like, I notice when I listen to headphones versus my car versus a train, I have a different interest in certain music. It's funny. Like, I used to want a lot more get-up-and-go music in the car, you know, and then on a train I'd listen to something different. And I don't know. I'm optimistic that you're going to get higher quality eventually once you get larger. You know, you have a terabyte iPod, you know, and you can put the largest size you want. And I'm also optimistic that I think once about new music, cause I think a lot of folks are excited at first just to get all these bands and music they've always liked throughout their life into this organized fashion, and they can see it, and it's all categorized nicely. But once they get that, they get bored of all the stuff they've had all those years, and then they still search out for new music, you know. But there's that in-between period, I think, that we're kind of still going through, where you watch a lot of things slump because people are still just trading the Billy Joel, you know, like and getting it. You know, I remember when I first started college, everyone was so excited about the standards, you know, Billy Joel and like here's, you know, Steve Miller Band and this and that. And it was funny, is that it passed in about a week or two, and then they wanted something new because they got it organized, you know.
But it's crazy to think about music culture. I mean, think about with the advent of Napster, when Napster first came around. If you were 9 years old 10 years ago, theoretically, you could be 19 right now and have never bought a CD. So the culture of buying and consuming music is different from an upper demo to a younger demo. So you're definitely seeing that change.
Well, there's also a whole generation of people that never had to pay for music if they didn't want to.
Right.
Columbia should put out 8 SanDiscs for a penny. You know, because that's how they got us when we were younger, is that, you know, 8 CDs for a penny.
Oh, yeah, this music club.
And man, I got roped into so many more later on. But
But Jordan, from a production standpoint, with all the artists that you work with, you know, it's an important part of your new album, is making sure the production quality is top notch.
You know, it definitely, you know, so for artists who are you know, I've got one client who is really bummed out about the fact that the way most people are listening to music now is off of iTunes. You know, I mean, most people can't tell the difference between a file that's compressed for iTunes, something that's on a CD or vinyl. But when you have an artist who's very, very particular, or very, very concerned about the process in the recording studio and getting certain sounds, you do lose something. So, yeah, I think that you know, we've had conversations about, you know, when is there going to be like almost like the super audio downloadable record where it's a higher bit rate, higher quality than what's currently offered?
You know? Yeah, they put that out and nobody wanted to buy them. Right. Super audio CDs, DVD audio. Yeah. But, I mean, I agree that A, most people don't really care that much about beyond maybe 192 or 256K bitrate codecs about the quality. However, it's only going to become less of an issue because there's already more stores upgrading to higher quality files. There will be lossless stores, or there are lossless stores right now. And as bandwidth and storage become less expensive, then the quality will go up. So it's going to get better, at least, I think.
Reclose, where would that be at? Remember, I'll end it with this, or the last part of your question, though, about the current state of the music industry. And ultimately, it's going to have to find a way to generate revenue stream. They're going to have to find new ways to generate profits and generate money, whether it's, you know, ringtones, which became a huge part of making money, or record labels signing 360 deals where they invest in the whole artist, where they're making money from merch and tour support. The importance of touring, publishing, getting your songs in commercials and all that. So there's, you know, for me, the most important part of what we all talked about, we talked about the evolution of music and how the process of obtaining music has changed. But for me, the most important, the foundation of what we all do right now is that there's still passion for it. And that, to me, is the most important thing. The process may change. The vehicle may change of how a generation obtains music. But as long as they still give a shit about music and still are passionate about new bands and exciting new artists, to me, that still gives me hope about what we do up here and the state of music. So how was that for a closing statement? Will that work? Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I want to thank, again, Caroline, for having us up here, the Commonwealth Club in Forum.